it starts out with a question, sort of a basic question. Do you believe that a perfect biological copy of your brain, when alive, in an identical body, would produce a conscious mind with your memories and personal characteristics? In other words, a conscious person perceiving, behaving, and responding in a way that you would in the same situation. And then the possible answers, the possible directions you can go with this are yes, or no, the brain and body would not produce a conscious person, or no, the resulting conscious person would be significantly different, and then other. On each one of the steps in this adventure, we also allow people to specify other and give us some input, because then we can see if we've forgotten things and this tree can grow further.
Auxoro is a media platform designed to help you think better, create engaging conversations, and inspire you to do dope shit. We host podcasts like the one you're about to listen to, make videos, write articles, and share the work of interesting people. Whether we speak with doctors, designers, athletes, or music artists, we know that this conversation will leave you with a different perspective, and we hope that this conversation inspires you to live a more fulfilling life. If an episode of this podcast has made your life better in some small way, please take a few seconds to send this show to someone else. The best way to spread love is to share what you love. If you'd like to keep up with all things Auxoro, you can follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and subscribe to The Source, our twice-monthly newsletter. In this action-packed email, we send you the latest Auxoro content, as well as articles, podcasts, books, shows, and other content we find exciting and useful. Go to auxoro.com/thesource or visit the link in the podcast description to join over 10,000 other subscribers. Also, you can now support Auxoro on Patreon for just a few bucks a month. On Patreon, you get early access to Auxoro guest episodes, exclusive access to weekend episodes of our daily insights podcast, The Aux, and exclusive access to Bro Logic, a podcast where my two brothers and I give our unfiltered views on what's happening in the world. Go to patreon.com/Auxoro or visit the link in podcast description to become a patron today. Thank you for your support. This time, I sit down with Randall Kunu, a neuroscientist, neuroengineer, and co-founder of CarbonCopies.org, an organization that provides support to scientists working on whole brain emulation. Their mission states, "We believe that the possibilities and opportunities afforded by whole brain emulation represent the most promising technological path to overcoming our fundamental limitations as a species and as individuals." This is Randall's second time on the podcast, and round two was an absolute pleasure. This time, we discussed the basis of what whole brain emulation and mind uploading means for society, if we can really map the entire human brain within 100 years, the problems of startup culture, what makes the brain so beautiful that the average person may not see, and more. Without further ado, please enjoy this deep dive with Randall Kunu. Thank you, Randall, for taking the time to hop on the podcast. I think a good place to start, even though for the first round we did go through a lot of your background and overview, I think it would be useful for people who may not have listened to the first episode for you to give a brief background on who you are, what you do, and the general field of whole brain emulation and mind uploading, just a kind of like a 30,000 foot view of what you do.
So hi, my name is Randall Kunu. I'm a computational neuroscientist by training. The thing that I'm most known for is this thing called whole brain emulation, which is the science and engineering behind a sci-fi topic known as mind uploading. So this concept of being able to somehow transfer your mind into something that isn't your biological brain. Think of, say, a robot or a giant computer cloud that has you running around in a virtual reality or something of that nature. That's the idea behind mind uploading, which has been seen in a lot of movies and other shows like Altered Carbon, for instance, which has been on recently. And whole brain emulation is, I would say, the only serious approach that would get you there, which is an approach where you attempt to collect all of the data from the brain that is necessary to recreate in some other system, like a computer, working reconstruction of how your brain works when it's in biology. So of the functions that it's generating. So of course, because you're recreating something like that in a computer, it's not going to have biological neurons, it's not going to have biological synapses, it's not going to have chemistry of that sort. I suppose you could perhaps do that through synthetic biology, but right now, if we were to implement something like this, it's going to be in silicon. And what you're really trying to capture, the thing that you're trying to recreate, is everything that you can sense, everything that you can experience. So all of the cognitive functions, that's the being able to see and hear, being able to move your arms and make something happen, even if those arms are, you know, some kind of sophisticated robot, or if it's virtual body that you're moving around, or what have you, that sort of thing. Plus, of course, emotions and memory and attention and consciousness and the sense of awareness, the sense of being. All of those things are part of what the biological brain is typically responsible for. And if you're going to do whole brain emulation, then you want that emulated brain to do all the same things. And okay, this sounds really fantastical. So to step back just a bit, we could say, well, as a first approximation, as something that is happening in the next few decades, what we're really working on is neural prosthesis. So it's this idea of, well, if we can create functions in a computer that are like what the brain is doing, maybe we can replace little pieces of the brain. For instance, pieces of the brain that aren't working well anymore, or parts of the brain where you need a little boost, where you need something to work a bit better. And examples that I probably talked about on the previous podcast were things like the prosthetic replacement for the human hippocampus, part of the brain that's really relevant for making memories. But also, you know, there are neural prostheses out there, or work on neural prostheses for bits of what you might call the brain, like the retina in the eye, or the cerebellum, which is the part of the brain that is responsible for connecting your body with your brain. And now all of that computation that's necessary for being able to move your limbs around and being able to realize what your posture currently is and all of that.
You mentioned altered carbon. And for someone who's a layman like me that developed an interest in whole brain emulation and then eventually linked up with you for the first podcast, for someone who may have not even dived into any research papers or a website like Carbon Copies, if you could direct them to one science fiction resource, whether it's a film or TV show or book, something where you could only choose one and say, this will give you the best conceptual understanding of what we're trying to do, what resource would you point them towards?
Okay, so that's actually not the right question to ask me, unfortunately, because I'm not nearly as knowledgeable of science fiction as I ought to be.
Would be a better question.
Well, you know, I mean, there are some that I personally happen to have read and that I like. Mm-hmm. And, you know, one that I've mentioned many times before in other interviews is Arthur C. Clarke's story, The City and the Stars. But that's because I happen to be a fan of the classics. But I also, you know, I like some of the more modern takes on it as well. And some of it doesn't even have to be books. I enjoyed watching Battlestar Galactica just because I like the fact that the Cylons have mind uploading, right? You know, they can return back into new bodies in a sense that is very much like what I would like people to think of when they think of whole brain emulation and mind uploading, because you don't want to think of it as somehow ending up in a clunky tin box or in a hard drive on a shelf somewhere. You want to think of it as ending up in a very sophisticated artificial body that has at least as many senses as a human does. So when you see the sort of depiction that you find in Battlestar Galactica, it's a pretty good depiction in a sense. You know, if we don't get too much into the story about who's the bad guys and who's the good guys and all of that.
Yeah, I suppose a better question would have been, out of all the science fiction you've consumed, which one would be your favorite depiction of mind uploading? So Battlestar Galactica is one of those for you.
Of the modern ones, yeah, it is. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So for people listening to this, maybe months or years in the future, we're recording this at the beginning of April 2020 in the midst of the coronavirus COVID-19 pandemic, where much of society is socially isolating, socially distancing. For you personally and for the work and research that you're able to do, how has the current pandemic affected how you're able to make further progress in your field?
Definitely has had an impact on me right now, because it so happens that I got back to the San Francisco Bay Area just a few weeks before the pandemic hit. And that was after spending about a year and a half up on Orcas Island off the coast of Washington, not so far from Vancouver Island. And back then, much of what I was doing was done remotely. And that's still possible right now. So that's fine. That's okay. That's definitely a kind of a benefit in the current situation. But because I just got back and I was reconnecting with everyone and setting up meetings and trying to get involved with projects here and all of that, it changes the nature of how all of that works. And as everyone is trying to switch over to working from home and meeting people remotely, there's definitely a delay involved. And there's a lot of stuff that we just have to get used to and learn how to do properly. So I'd say it's slowed things down considerably for the last few weeks. Not on all fronts, but on some for sure.
I would think that a pandemic like this would almost jumpstart the desire to have technology like whole brain emulation, because we have, you know, thousands and possibly millions of people that will succumb to COVID-19 by the end of the pandemic when things start to settle down. And there's a lot of smart people right now that are getting sick and frontline healthcare workers, where we would benefit being able to tap into their minds, even though their body may not be in a condition where they can offer services to people and help people. And when you have a field with a bunch of smart people in it, a lot of times the knowledge is of an area is concentrated to maybe hundreds or maybe a few thousand people. So if those people get knocked out, then you're at a severe disadvantage. Have you thought about the implications of mind uploading at a time like this and what it would mean to have that going in a future?
Yeah, I've thought about it. I mean, over the years, we've thought about it a lot, of course, because it's not the first time that there's been a pandemic on Earth. It's just that this is one of the very few times it's actually hit us over in the United States directly. So I've thought about it a lot before. Not specifically about this case, because, of course, all of the technology is so far away right now that it's not going to apply to the situation at hand. But you're right. Not only would having at least good sort of machine computer, you know, brain machine interfaces available could be a way for example, someone to care for a patient at a distance, not expose themselves to a virus, and make their expertise available in a hospital setting, even if they themselves cannot go to the hospital because they have to isolate themselves. That's all true, and that could be very useful. And then furthermore, of course, if you actually had whole brain emulation, then we would be talking about a whole different situation. And I'm not going to say that computers never get viruses, because they do, of course. Mm. but know, backups help a lot. And it's very hard to have backups of biological people. So when people are in danger of losing their lives to a virus like this one, it just, you know, beyond it being a virus specifically, it again demonstrates how fragile we really are as individuals. And that's something that we always have to struggle with one way or another. If I were to just go on about sort of science fiction scenarios of what you could do if you had mind uploading, we can come up with strange situations where you would say, well, what if we needed 10 more doctors? Well, you could just make 10 copies of the doctor with the same brain and all the same expertise and everything. But it would be weird to come up with a scenario like that, because you can't really imagine that a future would exist in which everything is exactly the same and we have the same problem with these hospitals and the virus, and we just need more doctors. The only thing that's different is we have mind uploading. That's just not going to happen.
Yeah.
You know, society is going to be totally different at that point, at least to some, in some respect. But that doesn't take away from the fact that this is this sort of problem, pandemics and biological vulnerability, also the necessity to be somewhere, to be able to do something rather than being able to be at a distance and carry out things through remote connections and virtual reality and all of that. These are all considerations that play a part in the motivation for why something like mind uploading is interesting as a way for society to move forward and to, you know, just to be more robust in a sense.
You've obviously spent a lot of time working side by side with people in the field of whole brain emulation and have spoken to many different personalities and researchers and have gotten to know people well. What do you think is an early experience that separates you from other people in the community or something that may give you different insights than what most bring to the table?
Ooh. Don't most people have different developments and bring new insights to the table? I'm just wondering what exactly you're asking about.
Yeah, everyone would have different insights to bring to the table. But for you on an individual level, what would be one of those early experiences in your life that would have produced your insight, the insight that you are bringing that other people in your community may not have, or an experience that others haven't likely went through?
And when you say my community, you mean that I have that other people who are working on whole brain emulation don't have? Or who are you comparing with here?
Other people working on whole brain emulation, yeah.
Well, I guess, you see, the interest in the field and also the number of people involved with it one way or another has grown over time. And I guess one of the things that that I have that maybe many of the people working in the field now don't is I'm old. I was there from back when it was still not popular at all. So it was just, you know, when you're there at the start, then you're automatically a pioneer. I don't think that there is anything very special or particular that, I don't know, that gives me the skill or the ability to get into these sorts of ideas and then others don't have them. I think a lot of people have very similar ideas. It's just that we all have a variety of different goals, and then sometimes something becomes extremely important for you or not so important. It's your first or second priority. I think one thing that really mattered to me is that this is just a lot of fun tinkering with stuff, but that's something that also isn't really unique to me. Most engineers have that feeling as well, and artists too. Artists love to create and tinker, and it's just this, you can make something, you know? I mean, so for instance, back when I used to play more computer games, there used to be these role-playing games where you had to go through various map-based areas and stuff, and it quickly became obvious to me that I was having way more fun just designing the maps or programming the games than playing them. So creating the thing that then you get to play with is just a lot of fun. It's so much fun to dive in there. And I think a lot of programmers can understand that as well.
Yeah.
But that's not really unique. So I'm not sure if I have a unique experience that somehow made me different from other people in some way such that I would do what I'm doing. A lot of coincidence, perhaps. So the sort of thing that you get involved with and the kind of project that you happen to not drop and keep on working on. Yeah, I'm sorry that it's not more fantastical than that. It would be nice if there was a great origin story, but...
That's a good answer. When you mentioned being older, even if that's not a particularly unique trait, it still allows you to think about situations in a way that other people can't without that experience. Like you mentioned that you've been through pandemics before, and one of the big differences that it's hitting us now, but even the pandemics that haven't hit the US as hard, like I don't really remember the pandemics of the earlier 2000s much at all, because I was maybe 9 or 10 years old. And for people that go through something multiple times, I think they tend to have a a more informed outlook and maybe a more realistic outlook and maybe able to point to better solutions having seen how things unfolded before. So even if being older isn't unique, I think it's still interesting.
Yeah, you were talking about other pandemics. There is, of course, another thing that the United States went through that was really jarring to those of us who lived through it. And I'm not talking about 9/11, which is, I guess I was just a teen, young teen at the time, but the AIDS epidemic of the 80s, that was big and that was scary. That really ravaged so many communities. And, you know, by now we've almost forgotten that that was a big deal because it's no longer as big of a deal, but it was a really big deal. It was different, of course, because it didn't move at the sort of speed that coronavirus does, but it also impacted thousands of lives, took thousands of lives.
Do you see any similarities between how people are reacting to the AIDS pandemic with the coronavirus? Because I don't think there are as many unknowns about how the coronavirus works as there was when AIDS first came into our system.
You're totally right. It's very different in that sense. I mean, this is a kind of flu. It's a terrible one, but it's a kind of flu, and we do understand a lot more about how that works. AIDS was really a mystery in how to tackle it, and it took so long to actually develop something that sort of works. And here we're just looking at a year or less than a year, half a year hopefully, to get a vaccine. Plus, all of the things that people are afraid of right now are probably the right things to be afraid of, which, of course, they weren't in the AIDS pandemic, which, yes, I'm calling it a pandemic. I think other people have done that too. Because, you know, here you don't want to get too close to someone. You're worried that if you're getting close to someone who has coronavirus, that you're going to get it too. Yeah, you can. Now, that wasn't the case in AIDS. Of course, you can't get AIDS by being breathed on by someone who has AIDS. But people were worried about that sort of thing back then because it wasn't entirely clear if that was possible. But now we know that that's nonsense, that you don't have to worry about that sort of transmission. So yeah, they're completely different in that sense. I think the only thing that's similar is that it was really a health crisis that gripped a whole population and caused at least some sense of panic.
Are you still of the belief that we will have a human brain completely emulated within 100 years from now? I don't want to misquote you.
Yeah, unless this crisis is in fact the apocalypse and society crumbles, then I do still think that within 100 years it's one of those time spans where I would just be surprised if the sciences we have today would not be able to figure out how to emulate how a brain works, even if it's just the brain of a fruit fly or the brain of a worm, the C. elegans nematode, within the next few decades to figure out how that works and to run that in a computer. And if that's possible, then you're really only talking a few more decades at most to scale up to the size of what's going on in the human brain. So it's just hard to imagine that unless we run into a serious showstopper that we just can't see right now, or if society crumbles, that's the alternative, right? Or there's the third one, if laws are put in place that say this is illegal, you cannot go in that direction. Any of those things happen, then perhaps it won't come about in that time span. But otherwise, I would be surprised if within 100 years this was not a reality for humanity.
Okay. So assuming that society doesn't crumble and that the laws remain kind to whole brain emulation and the potential of it, let's assume that I'm a complete skeptic of you being able to upload a mind within 100 years, which I'm not, but let's just say I'm 100% skeptical. What would you tell me to get me to embrace your view or hold your views more closely to how you see things?
Well, it depends on what kind of skeptic you are. You always have to ask a person what it is that they object to, because it could be that someone is just objecting to the number 100 and would be happier with 200. Or it could be that someone says, oh no, that's going to be 100,000 years. Or someone might say, this is never going to happen. And in all three of those cases, you'd want to ask why. Why do you think it would take 100,000 years? what is it that you think could take that long? I mean, look at the history of humanity and how long, you know, how long has it been since we built pyramids? We're talking about 5,000 years. And then you go all the way back to that. And before that, just a few thousand years before that, we were hunter-gatherers. How come, if you look at this history, would it take 100,000 years from here to get to something like mind uploading? So that one is weird to me, and I don't know what the explanation would be. But if someone says it's 200, not 100, then I'll say, okay, sure. You have slightly different estimates of the kind of things we might run into in terms of how much money is needed for this, or how many other projects are going on that are of national importance, or how fast we can collect the necessary data and analyze and interpret it because of the number of people working in the field, or whether AI is going to help us with that or not. So you can have all sorts of personal ideas about how the future will unfold that could make that kind of a factor difference that could explain that. So 100 or 200, to me, that's not really a difference. This is still someone who thinks it's going to happen. They just didn't feel comfortable saying 100. They're comfortable with 200. Now, if someone says it's never going to be possible, that's when it gets interesting, because then you start to talk about hypotheses about the brain and what it means to exist, to be, what it means to be human, all of that. And then you could be talking about technical issues. And I don't know if you've seen the new book that Miguel Nicolelis just published, but that is about technical issues, at least in his opinion. Or you could be talking about metaphysical issues. So issues that have more to do with your belief in what would constitute a successful mind upload. So actually surviving mind uploading and what that would mean. And those are two very different types of topics.
That's a good point. I mean, just pulling from my own personal skepticism in some areas where I'm no longer as skeptical, I think that the fantastical element of things that just seems so far down the road, if someone puts a tangible number on it, like 100 years for something like mind uploading, where the average person may think that that's pure science fiction, kind of like extrapolating my own skepticism onto other people that may be like me, it just like the, in a general layman sense, I think the fantastical element of mind uploading and the way that it sounds and is portrayed in science fiction may lead to skepticism when someone says, oh, like that's going to be 100 years from now. And then when you actually look into it and hear smart people talk about it like yourself, or read papers and are directed towards the right information, then that skepticism starts to disappear because it becomes more real. Like it's not just this thing that you saw on TV.
But to you then, I mean, if you just put yourself back into that place where you, let's say you hadn't read about all these things, what is it that you would find objectionable about the statement? Is it the number 100, or is it the thought that something like that would ever happen?
I think it's the it's probably more the number 100, because before I started reading about it, before I started learning about it, I would have said, you know, maybe 500 to 1,000 years in the future, at least, before we have an entire human mind uploaded. And that's with very limited understanding of it. That's just me. I think just the most of my knowledge coming from science fiction and none of it coming from the technical end probably led to that discrepancy, because it just seems like so far.
Yeah. So I mean, far-fetched. It's not a big gulf. I mean, if we said 100 or 200 is okay, then 500 is not that much different either. It's still within the realm of the sorts of time span that we can actually think about. You know, when we think back 500 years, we think to say the year 1520. Sure, it seems like it's a while ago and we didn't have electricity, but we can sort of comprehend what society was like back then. So it's not that totally different. We probably still know a few things that happened around that time, at least if we read our history books.
Mm-hmm.
So 500 years still seems like something that happens within the foreseeable time span of human development and human society, and that belongs then to the, you know, what we might project as the future history of humanity in a way, the way that things will develop and that are going to impact humanity. So if the only objection that someone has is that maybe they're thinking it's 500 years because, you know, they have no idea how long it's going to take to emulate a fruit fly or something like that, and how different that would be from emulating a human brain. That's not a very difficult argument to, it's not a very difficult mm-hmm. thing to argue about. It's not complicated. It's just, you just have to sort of agree to disagree about the exact numbers, but it doesn't really change what you're expecting will happen in the future.
And I guess also the level at which things are turning over, the level at which technology is advancing, just you made me think about 1620, like from 1620 to 1680, I wasn't there, but I imagine they looked pretty similar, or like from the year 1500 to 1550. But when I think about the year 2020 to 2070, that difference, I bet, is going to be a lot more striking than when you go back in time. So just knowing that now, how quickly things are changing, makes it easier to think, oh, like this, you know, that seems pretty possible. 100 years, like who knows what we're going to be doing 100 years from now.
Yeah, I agree.
So where does most of the funding come for whole brain emulation? Is it from government? Is it from private investors? A mix of both?
It differs. It depends on exactly what you call funding for whole brain emulation. So for instance, the work that was being carried out by Kernel and by Neuralink, both of which ties into whole brain emulation to some extent, is private funding. That's investment money. But then you have the Human Brain Project and the Brain Initiative in the United States and a number of other initiatives like it that are also doing work that's aimed in the same direction as whole brain emulation. It produces the type of outcome, the sort of data, knowledge about neural circuits that you need if you're going to do whole brain emulation. And that is all government money. But then you've got the Allen Institute that has a fantastic team working also in the same direction. And you've got Genelia Farms Research Campus, which is also a fantastic team working on that. And especially they're working on Drosophila, on fruit fly most of the time. And their money is private. It's an endowment. So you've got startups with investment, you've got endowments, you've got money from governments. And sometimes you've got little tiny bits and pieces here and there, like some money that the Human Brain Project makes available for people on the outside to use their systems mm-hmm. that we are now going to use for a project on developing a framework for guided neuromimetic prosthesis, sort of a making virtual brain slices that you can experiment with. That money just comes out of a trickle, a flagship project in the European Union that somehow we here in the United States are also able to make use of. So there are all kinds of little connections like that that put together the funding. But that's when you're counting all of the funds that somehow help progress whole brain emulation, because you're progressing computational neuroscience and prosthetics and neural engineering in general, not because you're putting money specifically into a project that has the title whole brain emulation. Mm-hmm. I would say that sort of money is extraordinarily rare still at this point. We have occasionally seen this. You could say that when the first funding went into Kernel and Neuralink, that was close. When Dmitry Itzkov put money into organizing a congress that was essentially entirely about whole brain emulation, that was money being put specifically into a project with that title. But in general, that's still very rare. Carbon Copies is is an organization that is exceedingly cash poor for that reason. Mm-hmm. And the only way that we do get projects going is by creating projects that aren't directly about, we want to make whole brain emulation, we want to build this virtual brain lab or something like that, and then you get some grant money for that. But that's not uncommon. You see the same sort of thing in most academic labs, where the professor of the lab has an interest, and that interest, you could describe that, you could give it a name, you could say this is the topic that a professor really loves. But the research money for that lab is not allocated to the lab based on that topic or based on that interest that professor has. Instead, they have to write up a grant where they're specifically saying, okay, we think that the modeling experiments that we're about to do, which happen to be modeling experiments that fit into my topic of interest, that they're going to potentially help Alzheimer's patients because we may be able to discover how to detect it more early or something like that. And then you get grant funding for it. So that grant funding was given to a grant for to a project that is ostensibly about something a little different, something that's specifically aimed at whatever the grant funding is meant for, but it contributes to the whole portfolio of work that is happening that's within that topic area that that professor cares about. So it's similar in that sense.
So I don't know if there's people dedicated in the whole brain emulation community for artistic portrayal to the general public that kind of take what you guys are researching and then making an almost like a whole brain emulation for dummies, like simulation or something like that on YouTube. The only reason I ask is because I was listening to Eric Weinstein on the most recent episode of Joe Rogan podcast, and he was kind of unloading his newest theory in physics and geometry, kind of like a way to combine the two. And he was talking a lot about Einstein and the theory of relativity, and it was very complicated. And he said that a huge part of getting the average person to understand it is collaborating with the arts community. And there are people that draw these models or make these animations that kind of have a general understanding of the field and then translate that through art that someone can watch a video on YouTube and says, like, this is kind of the what whole brain emulation looks like, maybe like a 10 or 15 minute recap. And there's kind of like series of videos of people that are putting it out there. Is there anything like that right now in the field of whole brain emulation?
There are two small projects in the works where we're trying to do what you might call a primer or an intro to whole brain emulation. And another one that is more about what is the Carbon Copies Foundation about. They are in extremely early stages because we really lack artists in a sense. And you're absolutely right that if we had a beautiful animation, a nice little story that could depict what we're trying to do or trying to tell, that would be very, very valuable. And I would love it if some people with the interest to help us make that, if they would reach out to us. We have three designers, graphic designers and artist types who are currently working with us, but they have very limited time because they, of course, have their main projects that they're working on as well. So that's something where, I don't know, if anyone's listening who is an artist and who would love to work on something like that and who would like to just check us out, see if they like what we're doing, and see if they enjoy collaborating with our team, would be awesome if we could have a few more hands just helping us out with that.
Yeah, if you're listening to this and you can design, definitely hit up Randall and Carbon Copies. Put your design skills to work. And if you have an interest in the human brain, that's even better.
We're really heavy on, I guess, computer scientists, neuroscientists, and engineers right now. And it would be great to have people from other areas of expertise join us as well.
Yeah, and going off of the private investing we were talking about before, there could be a link there where within the general population, you have scattered people that have a lot of money that may or may not have encountered whole brain emulation. And in order to fund something significantly with millions or billions of dollars, you need information to be in a digestible form where you're able to understand it and develop a passion for it. Like in order to have a passion for something, you first have to understand it. So the more artistic renderings or simulations or designs that are just out there for mainstream consumption, the better chance you have at, you know, luring in these big fish that say, hey, we want to kickstart this. We want to give something back to this community.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And previous experience also shows me that that's right. Yeah.
So what are the positions or beliefs you've changed your mind on most in the past 5 years? This could be a personal belief. It could be something within whole brain emulation, something that stands out.
Okay, so I'm going to address two of them, actually.
Sure.
One set of beliefs that has changed in the last, I'd say, yeah, maybe it's 5 years, but maybe it's 10 years, is the hope or belief that there is one best way to work on an ambitious project like this, that there is, that you could, you know, and by best way, I mean, this belongs in an academic lab, or this belongs in a startup because startups can pivot fast and just do whatever, or this belongs in some sort of major organization. From having tried a lot of these different paths and having discovered the sorts of things that they're good at versus the types of hurdles they bump into, it's become pretty clear that none of them are the solution as such, but that you can, you have to mix it up. You have to pull in all the different types of ways of working on this and always give them little chunks, little tiny projects. That's all that anyone can manage. Because let's say an academic lab is particularly good at persistence, at caring about one problem, one question, and then trying to solve it, even if it takes them 10 years. And they don't care about money. They don't care about the bottom line. They just want to find that answer. And they will, their prestige, their academic careers are based on that. If you want to be able to pull in the best talent necessary as quickly as you can, because you're trying to build a device, let's say a medical device or something like that, then a startup could be the right way to go, a well-funded startup, because those can just reshape themselves from 1 month to the next by pivoting as necessary, and they can pull in the best talent that you can find from anywhere. So there are very different benefits, but there are also different hurdles. So for instance, academia tends to often get lost in sort of tangential things that are a little bit slow. And there's also this habit of, for instance, emphasizing publishing a lot, even if what you're publishing are only tiny incremental steps, and maybe they're very debatable as to how much evidence there really is about how well you've shown that, that whatever you're trying to say is true is true. So there are all kinds of issues with the academic process as well. And in the startup culture, well, one of the biggest problems, of course, is that yes, they can pivot, but they tend to often pivot away from what the original purpose was to the point where the output is no longer as helpful as you wish it was. Mm-hmm. And that's something that happens very quickly, because a startup cannot survive unless it's producing something that will produce value within a very short time span. And so one of the things, I guess, that I've stopped doing is I've stopped hoping that there is this one path that you can just bite into and say, this is going to ride us all the way to the solution. Instead, it's going to have to be all of them together, lots of turnover, a new project every 2 years, and a whole bunch of those, that sort of thing. It's going to be messy. And that's just a realization that, you know, I've come to. And maybe that's not at all surprising, but I guess it is something that I wish weren't the case, because it would be easier if you could just set something up, let it go, keep on working on it, and then you get there, and it didn't have to be so messy. The second thing that I've changed my mind about, maybe not drastically, but enough so that it matters, is maybe 5 years ago, if you would have asked me, is it better to create whole brain emulation by the procedure that we call gradual replacement, so where you would, say, replace all of the parts of your brain one by one using small neural prosthesis some sort, whether it's individual neurons or hundreds of neurons at a time or millions of neurons at a time, but in any case, a gradual replacement, or if it's better to, say, preserve a brain, then take that brain out, that preserved brain, you know, it's, you take it and you slice it up, you scan it, and then you create a new brain, and that's your whole brain emulation. Those two processes, they may lead to technically exactly the same reconstructed brain. They may lead to the same functional brain in the end, if they both work. And some people will say they are also completely identical in terms of the success of mind uploading in that case. The person has survived in each case. And some people don't agree. Some people will say, I think gradual replacement works, but this scan and copy thing, that doesn't lead to survival. Sure, you've created a human being with a brain, even if they're in an artificial body, but that's not the same person. And that gets into this whole metaphysical thing that we've been debating for a while now. But over the last 5 years, I've become less worried about it, in the sense that I've grown less concerned about whether there's really something there that that I should be concerned about. And I think it's partly because I've just spent so much time now looking very closely at questions about consciousness and questions about personal identity or self-awareness, that it's become very apparent to me that that none of the paths that people go through in their thinking, in their sort of logical, or what they think is their logical rationale to arrive at one at a certain conclusion, they're typically not as well thought through as you might think, and they always bump into something that is really just, huh, I guess we just think that because we're used to it. And so I'm not sure which technology is going to win out in the end, but I don't worry about it as much as I might have 5 years ago, because I think that ultimately either of them would produce the same type of success if they work.
Is there one that you would not prefer, but is there one option out of those two that you think would lead to a better outcome if people agreed on one?
So if I were really worried about the metaphysical argument, as I might have been 5 years ago, then I might have said gradual would be better. But now I would say the opposite, because I would say that the actual process that you have to experience to replace everything part by part, understanding that to get it done, you would need replacements every minute of millions of neurons, because just count the number that's there and how long it takes to replace them all. Even gradual is not very gradual. It's actually very fast. But that's an extremely messy procedure. That's something that has so many possibilities for failure, for problems. That sounds very risky to me. So I would actually now perhaps lean to the other and say, if you want something that is more likely to be done within the next 100 years, something that is more likely to be done correctly and that will lead to the right results, then scan and copy is probably your safer bet. So if you don't have any problems with the metaphysics there, then you should go for that one.
This may be a dumb question, but say you do make a copy of someone's brain today. We have 100% of the technology and capability to do that. And so you have your brain and a copy of your brain and another substrate. How would the copy of that brain know that it's a copy, or would it not know that?
It wouldn't. I mean, think of it for a moment like the Battlestar Galactica version, right? Where they're uploaded into another body, they wake up. If they were never told that they just died and they woke up somewhere else, if it was somehow set up so that things look like they're in the same place, how would you even know that you were the copy? There's no way you would know if the brain actually works right.
Yeah.
And the body is pretty much the same, then you wouldn't know. So there are oodles of finicky sort of thought experiments that you can go through for these metaphysical questions. And I know this very clearly right now, because we just finished a workshop series where we had first consciousness and then personal identity being dealt with. And we talked to experts like Jeff McMahon, Paul Snowden, Keith Wiley, Christoph Koch of the Allen Institute, Michael Graziano, and several others, and collected all of that. And it's really interesting when you dive into all of those thought experiments where you can go. But because there are so many of them, and because they become this giant tree of questions you can ask, and where you can have a question, then another answer, and a question, another answer, we started looking at them as first as surveys that you could give someone to see, how do you think about this topic, and how can we make you think very carefully about the topic. Mm. And then I'm trying a new approach. There's a mini project that we're doing on metaphysics of mind uploading right now. And the approach I'm trying is basically a choose your own adventure approach. I don't know if you're familiar with those things. This was a long time back. There were books where you would open up to a certain page and then it would say, you know, after you mm-hmm. part of the story, now will you go to page 74 or page 83, depending on which page you go to, because which solution you chose or which step you chose, you get a different adventure.
Yeah, I remember some of those books. There was a recent Black Mirror episode. I didn't watch it, but apparently you were able to choose different outcomes of the episode, and that split the public opinion. Some people loved it, some people hated it, but yeah, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No, that's fine. That's a great example. But yeah, so we're using an approach like that to allow people to traverse the possible rationales that are there, the sort of thought experiments you can think about, and to then see, to try to tally up who thinks what and why and what needs more clarification. And if you want, because I happen to have it open right here, I can read you an example of a question that's in there just so you can get a feel for it.
Yeah, that'd be great.
So, you know, it starts out with a question, sort of a basic question. Do you believe that a perfect biological copy of your brain, when alive, in an identical body, would produce a conscious mind with your memories and personal characteristics? In other words, a conscious person perceiving, behaving, and responding in a way that you would in the same situation. And then the possible answers, the possible directions you can go with this are yes, or no, the brain and body would not produce a conscious person, or no, the resulting conscious person would be significantly different, and then other. On each one of the steps in this adventure, we also allow people to specify other and give us some input, because then we can see if we've forgotten things and this tree can grow further. Now, would you care to wager a response to that one?
Today, I say yes. There would be a time in the past where I would say no, that, you know, there is some extra layer of entity above the copy of a human brain that makes us what we are. But today I would say yes.
Okay. So we chose yes. And then you end up in the next question, which says, cyber is cool. Do you believe that a perfect emulation of your brain implemented via some non-biological machine embodied with great care would produce a conscious mind with your memories and personal characteristics? For this question, imagine that you can request an arbitrary degree of precision in the emulation, right down to the atomic interactions if you so desire. And again, it's yes or...
So would a copy of my brain, a perfect copy, down to the atomic level, have the same personality and memories as me right now?
It's asking now about an implementation where we're implementing an emulation of everything right down to the atomic level if you want, but it's being emulated in something that is not biological. So something that is a computer, for example.
Okay. And then would that have my personality and memories?
Yeah.
Oh, I don't know.
What sort of response would you...
I would say it may have my personality and memories, but depending on the type of computer, it may not be able to communicate my personality or memories to other people, depending on the computer's limitations. So what if it can only, you know, give simple text answers, maybe one sentence at a time, or will the computer have facial expressions, things
like that? This is a perfect example of where the other point comes in very well, because the way we wrote it, when we wrote embodied with great care, we just assumed that implicitly meant, you know, you could assume any kind of embodiment that you want. It could be just like a Cylon from Battlestar Galactica or something. But it clearly, that's not clear enough, right? So here you would say other, and then you would specify your concern, and then we would work on through that. But just to give you a sense of where this is headed, as you sort of work your way through these things, we begin talking about whether the implementation is allowed to be software instead of just, you know, some sort of super hardware that is not biological. And then we go into more metaphysical questions about it. This is, you know, it has to get more difficult. And so we start talking about interruptions, for instance, because people have all sorts of beliefs about what means that you survived, that you are still you. Is your consciousness allowed to disappear for certain moments of time? Or is a stream of consciousness allowed to disappear? Or does it have to remain there, or some kind of activity in the brain? So we ask the question, you require a major surgery to save your life, and the surgeons choose to use deep hypothermic circulatory arrest to treat you. This is a real surgical technique that involves cooling the body to low temperatures and stopping blood circulation and brain function for up to 1 hour. During that hour, there's no brain activity. After the procedure, they take you to a hospital room 50 meters away. They bring you back to normal body temperature and you're revived. And now the answers are either the person who wakes up after the procedure is the same person as you, the inert material of your brain preserved you, or the person who wakes up after the procedure is a different person than you, or other.
It's a tough one. I mean, I guess it would be the same person. And is what you're getting at there that if you can consider that the same person, then why not consider mind uploading the same person? Because if you shut off your brain for an hour and then you bring it back.
Oh, it's a little more, I guess, detailed than that, because we're not trying to jump someone straight from thinking, oh, well, maybe having my consciousness or my brain activity interrupted for a moment doesn't mean I disappear.
Mm-hmm.
And then jumping them straight to, well, then mind uploading is fine no matter how you do it. That would be wrong because there are so many other questions there.
Mm-hmm.
But instead, we kind of take them from one step to the next step. So, you know, after you're okay with an interruption, then the next step is we ask about what sort of interruptions, like how long is an interruption allowed to be? Or we ask about materialism, about whether it's okay if, let's say, you go through a teleporter. And let's say it's not really the teleporter that you see in Star Trek, but instead it's the kind where it just takes you apart. All of your atoms are given labels so that you know exactly which one was where. And then it takes the same atoms right in that same spot and puts you back together again instantly. Are you still the same person? Or did you just disappear? Did someone else just get created?
Yeah. I like these questions because it...
Yeah, in great detail to try to think through all of these steps where you might initially think, oh, well, such and such can't work because obviously, and then you say something, but then when you think about it more carefully, as you noticed, it's often a bit of a tricky question. It's complicated. You don't really understand why you believe that something is the way it is. It's perhaps just because we're used to it.
Yeah, that's why I like it, because it makes me think those types of questions. It's some of them, there's an immediate answer that comes to mind, and in others, maybe I might say one thing now, and then an hour from now, I'd change my mind. But the framing of the question will definitely, in one way or the other, change how you view whole brain emulation. Like a primer question. I like that.
Yeah, it's very strange. It feels like when you talk to even philosophers. And this is something I noticed in speaking with Paul Snowden, as well as with Jeff McMahon and others, is they often are willing to say, yes, materialism is something that I believe in 100%, and I am reductionist, and I am irrational. I think that everything that Derek Parfit said about personal identity and self and all of that is all true, but I do not agree with Derek Parfit when he said, well, if you disappeared right over here and through a stroke of lightning, a person with exactly your brain was created on the other side of the world, that is then you. I don't think that because, and then they come up with some reason, and the reasons are sometimes sound really deep. They sound like, for instance, well, there has to be a causal connection. But then, you know, if you think about causality, well, a machine that is reading your brain and getting the blueprint and then creating a part of, that's a causal connection. It's not a coincidence that it produced you over there. So often these things that even the philosophers will say, it feels like they would just want them to be true, but they haven't really got a very good reason for it. And then they'll hold certain beliefs at a time, such as, okay, it's okay as long as your brain is still your brain, if it's still the biological matter, even if all the activity ceases, even if you freeze it and wake it up in 100 years, it's still the same brain, so you're still in there. So that's okay, as long as it's still the same material, even if the activity is gone. Now, it's also okay to replace bits and pieces at a time, but you can't replace them all at once because there needs to be some sort of period in which they become you, kind of with a ship of Theseus idea of replacing planks, but those planks have to travel with the ship a few times to get worn down to become part of the ship or something. And then it sort of turns into this argument where it's either the material has to be preserved or there needs to be some time going by during this replacement process, but it's never entirely clear what's supposed to be happening in that time, because there's no requirement for there to be some sort of soul or something that is kind of infecting the other new parts of the brain, because that would be dualism. That wouldn't be materialism. You would be believing in some extra thing that needs to go and infect that, basically, right? Like a sort of virus of self. And it's really interesting just to see the sort of the twists, you know, the mental twists that you can sort of see people pretzeling themselves into there.
Yeah, well, maybe the ego has a little bit to do with it too, because everyone wants to believe, including myself, that there's something special and non-replicable about inner being and their brain, and that if you make a copy of their brain, that would be able to function as their consciousness does right now and have their personality and have their memories. I think everyone wants to believe that there's something special about them, like something that you can't reproduce. And even if you do reproduce it, you're missing like that little touch of whatever it is that's you.
But we tend to have those sorts of beliefs about ourselves and about humans. But even if we believe that machines can be conscious, let's say R2-D2, for instance, we don't have the same problem there. We don't tend to think, well, if at night R2-D2 is charging and someone comes and turns off his brain and then replaces all of the chips and replaces the hard disk, but it's got the same software on it and it's got exact same content and the same types of chips, is it still R2-D2? We would be more willing to say that's still R2-D2, even though it's exactly the same procedure as the one where all of your parts were just replaced. And we only make this exception because we're talking about biology and about humans. But it is nice to see, though, that the professional philosophers, they have at least the insight to have a kind of humility or humbleness that comes with not really knowing how to express their objection. So, for example, Jeff McMahon was very explicit about that. He said that I should know that in the past, every time when he has disagreed with Derek Parfit, in the end, he tended to come around and take Derek Parfit's position.
I'm sure from studying how the brain works on a physical level, you've grown to understand many more parts of consciousness and what we consider the conscious experience. I'm sure from the physical understanding that also leads to a better understanding of consciousness in many areas. Is there an area in particular that maybe you were surprised to learn something about consciousness, or something that you weren't expecting to come from your study of how the brain is put together?
Not about how it was put together, but I was kind of surprised by a recent MRI study about brains that were subjected to, well, brains, people who were taking LSD as part of a study and what that was doing to the activity in their brain. Because I guess just based on prior readings and experience and so forth, my assumption was that largely what happens is a deregulation, that systems in the brain become not well synchronized, that the sort of the brain-wide oscillations that are keeping regions, the activity of regions in synchrony to the point where they can communicate well with each other, that those break down. And that's why, for example, you would see interesting colorful patterns and things like that, because where the visual system normally requires that the parts that are seeing certain types of features are operating in sync with the parts that are seeing other types of features, and that's what gives you complex object recognition, instead you're getting these repeated patterns that are more at the lower level of vision. That's what I had assumed, but that turned out not to be true for at least for all areas of the brain. It turns out that there are large parts of the brain where the synchronous activity actually got upregulated and it became more active. So I'm still trying to think through how that ties in with the experience of consciousness in those situations, in like either meditation or psychedelic experiences. I'm not quite clear on what to make of that yet. So that was a little bit surprising recently.
Yeah. Well, I think it will become clearer now in the future, or clearer sooner, because it seems like psychedelics are making a comeback and people being able to study them. I know Johns Hopkins recently just reopened a psychedelic research center, and Tim Ferriss was involved in donating, I think, $2 or $3 million to that. And the stigma that psychedelics have had the past few decades seems like it's starting to evaporate a little bit and will be more openly studied And so I would be interested to see what connection there is between what we find out from psychedelics and how the brain works, and maybe if any of that could be useful with whole brain emulation.
Yeah, I feel the same way.
So if policymakers that affect whole brain emulation, if you take the policymakers in general and you could make them understand one thing better about whole brain emulation that they don't understand now, what would you want that to be?
I think what I would like them to understand better is that it is in principle the same thing as neural prosthesis, except applied to the whole brain. So there is nothing that is out of, say, the area of very conservative fundamental neuroscience. No assumptions are being made that are in any way outside of normal neuroscience. In fact, we're the most conservative neuroscientists. We don't assume anything about there being something like what Christoph Koch is arguing in his IIT, or Miguel Nicolelis with his electrical fields having some sort of influence on consciousness, or something purely reductionist, taking it apart as a machine and this is how pieces work. It's the same sort of thing. You do neural prosthesis research, brain emulation research is the same thing, except applied to a whole brain, whether that's a fly or a human. And in that sense, this is no different than work being done on artificial intelligence. It's working on cognitive functions and looking at them as a computational system. This is coming. This is something that's going to happen. Just like AI is going to have an effect on society, being able to work on parts of the brain, of the human brain, or the entire one, is going to have an effect as well. And policymakers should realize that while these things are not happening tomorrow, so it's not something that's going to affect their re-election right away, this is something that, just like AI, we should take into account in planning for the future.
Would you say that you find the brain more beautiful than the average person?
That's such a strange thing to ask. It's like, do you think that a Ferrari is more beautiful than this house over here?
Yeah. I have a question in mind.
Oh, you have a question in mind. Okay.
As a follow-up.
So my answer is, do I think the brain is more beautiful than the average person? No.
Do you suspect that you find the brain more beautiful than the average person finds the brain? Not do you think brains are more beautiful than people?
Oh, that's what you're asking. Oh. In the sense of more interesting, something that you would love to spend a lot of time.
Yeah, yes. I should have phrased that better.
Probably I do, but I'm not unique in that either. It's like, ask any neuroscientist.
As someone who is a neuroscientist, could you articulate what it is that you find more beautiful about the brain that someone that doesn't have your background may not see or may not have been looking for?
That's obvious. If you don't have a background where you feel like you could even begin to look at the brain in some functional way, in some detail, because it just seems like this mass, this organ that you have no idea how to even get into, then it's hard to find the beauty where you want to spend a lot of time thinking about it or studying it, because it's just, that's, how do you even begin? You don't know where to go. But if you do have the capacity, if you've learned to look at what is really going on in the brain in some sense, like neuroscientists have and others who learn about brain function, then what you're looking at is this thing that ultimately explains why we behave the way we do, why we are who we are, what makes us do what we do. This whole, if you're interested at all about yourself or about others, if you're interested in people, if you're interested in society and why society is the way it is, in the end, it all comes down to brains and brain function and what those brains are making us do. So that's why it's super interesting. And if you're not scared away because it's the brain and it's this thing that you can't really get into because it's just there and you don't understand it, if you're not scared away by that, then the beauty of it is just obvious because it connects. It's the foundation of all the rest, right? And I'm sure a physicist would go another step. They would say, well, actually, it's the universe and the laws of physics that is really the foundation of everything. And that explains why everything is the way it is. Mm-hmm. And that explains why we are who we are. Okay, granted. And physics is also super interesting. But, you know, One of them is a set of fundamental laws that have organizing principles. And if you have a gas with a billion molecules in it, you can study the gas as a whole and say how it behaves based on these laws of physics, even if you can't explain exactly what each of those individual molecules is doing. But in the brain, you've got a complex system, which means it's putting together the functions that are enabled by the laws of physics and that together make something more complex than what you had originally.
Mm-hmm.
So then when you look at the individual pieces and how they act together, then you begin to understand what that's doing. This is kind of the opposite of looking at a gas. So in that sense, yeah, sure. They're both super interesting, both foundational and fundamental. But this complex thing we call the brain is really about the specific topic of humanity.
That's definitely a different answer than, do you find the brain more beautiful than the average person? I didn't realize the other way that it could come out. So
I don't know why that's what I assumed you said, but yeah, sorry about that.
No, that's on me. I'm getting better at asking questions, hopefully in real time. So it's always best when I have a response to kind of give me feedback. So I enjoy the slip ups. So as we wrap up, what is the best way for people to follow the work of Carbon Copies? How can they support financially if they're able to? And where can they pick up some dope merchandise like the t-shirt that you're wearing? Because I definitely have to get one for myself.
Oh, yeah. So you can go to carboncopies.org. That's the main website for the organization, the International Carbon Copies Organization. We now have a few chapters as well, like the Sweden chapter. Just go to carboncopies.org. You'll find the store there. You'll find links on how to help out if you want to be a volunteer or if you're able to donate. There's also links there that'll tell you how you can donate either via PayPal or Bitcoin or as a patron. And you'll find other interesting things too. For example, the Choose Your Own Adventure is not on there yet, but will be. We're going to start a section on the metaphysics of mind uploading, and we'll have that link there as well. And there's also information on the same site on carboncopies.org that will lead you to our Facebook group where discussions are typically had, or Twitter, LinkedIn, all the other, and the YouTube, of course, our YouTube channel with recordings of our workshops, journal clubs, interviews with experts, and so forth.
Awesome. Well, thank you again, Randall, for hopping on the podcast. It's always a pleasure. And hopefully when we're out the other side of this pandemic, we can link up again soon, do round three. Thank you for tuning into this episode of Augzoro. If you haven't already, please hit us with a 5-star rating and comment on Apple Podcasts. This helps us appear higher in searches, which means more people will find out about Augzoro. Other ways to help get the word out is telling a friend, tagging us on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, writing a blog post, or supporting us with a donation on Patreon. We are a completely independent platform, and we're grateful for every listener who supports this podcast. Thanks for coming along for the ride, and I'll see you guys next time.